Hey there, it's Carolyn. Before we start today's podcast, I wanted to tell you about a brand new challenge that we have starting over in the Homestead Kitchen membership really soon. This one is all about making your very own herbal oils and culinary oils and cosmetic oils and turning them into salves and balms for your herbal medicine cabinet. If you're interested in joining me for the Herbal Oils and Salves Challenge, then go to homesteadingfamily.com/podcast-herbal-oils. Again, that's homesteadingfamily.com/podcast-herbal-oils.
Hey, you guys, this is Josh with Homesteading Family, and welcome to this week's episode of the Pantry Chat, Food for Thought. We've got an exciting guest today, a friend and mentor of mine, Joel Salatin, and we are going to be talking about starting a homestead business. I am getting more and more questions about how to start a homestead business, and I get it. People are moving to the country, you're looking for an alternative life, and you're looking for an alternative way to make a living as you make that transition, but it is a big step. Just homesteading is a big step. But then starting a business based on maybe some of your homesteading endeavors is another big step. And so we're going to talk about some key things you need to know, how to maybe think like a business person, and talk about some ideas for businesses to get started. And like I said, I'm really excited to have Joel here today. So Joel calls himself a Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. Others who like him call him the most famous farmer in the world. And some of us also call him the grandfather of the modern homesteading movement. With 15 published books and a thriving multi-generational family farm, he draws on a lifetime of food, farming, and fantasy to entertain and inspire audiences around the world. Joel's as comfortable moving cows in a pasture as he is addressing CEOs in a Wall Street business conference. And his speaking and writing reflect dirt under the fingernails experience punctuated with mischievous humor. He passionately defends small farms, local food systems, and the right to opt out of the conventional food paradigm. Four generations of his family currently live and work on Polyface Farm in Swoop, Virginia. Let's welcome Joel Salatin. Hey, Joel, how's it going today?
Going great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for joining me. Excited to talk to you. And I know folks are excited to learn a little bit about just some foundationals on starting a business on the homestead. But before we get into that, what is life like for you on the farm, on the homestead in Virginia right now?
Well, of course, we're just breaking to spring here. We've had, you know, 2 days of, this is our third day in the last 2 weeks, so we've hit 60 degrees. And so we've got a little bit of green grass, starting to show. And yeah, we'll be in full blown, whatever crisis mode now for the next 2 weeks as we transition from winter to spring and get animals that are inside, get them outside, and you know, all the transition stuff that we do at spring, it'll all hit us here in the next, you know, 3 weeks.
Yeah, kind of going from that winter walking maintenance to a full-on sprint here.
Yeah, full-on sprint. Yeah. So spring is always my favorite time. You have this kind of dormancy, everything's kind of sleepy, and then boy, you know, the birds come and the grass grows and, you know, everything's having babies, and boy, it's a really exciting time.
Yeah. We're looking forward to that, but of course we're in North Idaho, so we're quite a ways behind you. And we were having a light winter. I'm looking out the window here and we were thinking a couple days ago, well, maybe this is it. Maybe winter's done. Yeah. We woke up to 4 inches of snow this morning so I don't know, maybe we've still got a month to go. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, we can certainly have plenty of cold in March as well. We just don't know where it is, but that that green, what I call the green patina. In other words, the grass isn't really growing, but there's a kind of a green sheen on it, at least, instead of brown. And chlorophyll's coming back.
Yeah, nice. When do you think you'll get cows out into their first rotations?
I normally we're out grazing by the second half of March. So once March 15 comes, we've normally got enough grass to start maybe not grazing everything, but it obviously they go out in batches, different groups, and normally we can get out then. Last winter we had our first group out February 25. We had such a warm February. We actually had enough grass to graze, and we actually turned some things out on February 25th last year. That's the earliest we've ever done it, and we've gone as late as like April 7th. So it just totally depends on what kind of warmth and moisture we get. Like today, we just had a huge heavy shower downpour, but it's 61 degrees out there. So warm rain is just about as conducive to grass waking up as you can get.
All right. Well, it's exciting to see spring coming. And I'd love to talk more cows and grass, but we're going to talk business today. And homestead business. There are a lot of people. Obviously, you're very familiar with this. You're traveling all the time, talking to people all over the country and world and doing conferences. And so I'm sure you're seeing the same things. A lot of people not only adopting the homesteading life, but wanting to find a new way to make an income, to make a living as they make that transition. And I think that's great. I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I'm every much business person as I am homesteading. I love the principles of it. I think there's a lot of intersection in the discipline and the skills you need for a homesteading life and an entrepreneurial life. But I think a lot of people don't always realize that. They don't always realize what they're getting into, and that you need to not just learn a skill like, raising pastured chickens, but you need to learn some business skills and some entrepreneurial skills as well. So I'm hoping we'll be able to explore a little bit of that today. But I'd love to just for you to share a few minutes your story, because most of us that know you as a businessman, a farmer, an entrepreneur, and an author and many other things. But I don't think a lot of people maybe realize that you didn't start out an entrepreneur and a business person. So I'd love to hear the history a little bit of how you got started and got into farming there on your place in Virginia.
So mom and dad bought this place in 1961 when I was just 4 years old. And dad wanted to be a full-time farmer. He wanted to be a commercial full-time farmer. And he actually got advice. He brought in, people from the Extension Service. He hired Doan Management Consultants. I mean, he had both private and public people come tell him how we're going to make this small farm pay. And everybody's advice was chemical fertilizer, borrow more money, build silos, plant corn, all this stuff. And dad was an accountant. He ran a sharp pencil. And he knew that that was not the answer. We didn't have, I mean, our farm was a gullied rock pile. That's why we bought it. It was very, very cheap. Think about this, 550 acres, Josh, 550 acres in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia in 1961, a tractor, a hay rake, a mower, a baler, a hay wagon, the house, an equipment shed, a barn, all for $49,000.
Oh my goodness.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
It's so unimaginable.
So one of the reasons that we came here was because the land was so worn out, it was real cheap.
Yeah.
And so dad tried for a year or two and realized that we just but he couldn't figure out. I mean, I don't think at that time with what we knew and the state that the farm was in, the land, it couldn't be done. But that early experience made him dedicated to retail sales. As a small farm, he said, we cannot compete on volume. We have to compete on margin. So we have to wear the processor, the distributor, and the marketer hats, all those middleman hats, we need to wear those hats. So basically, he shut the farm down, and it was not doing much, you know, at all. And took a job in town. Mom started teaching school. Mom actually took a job off the farm before Dad did. He was a stay-at-home, you know, farm mom for a year. And then they both went out to work and took their salaries and paid the mortgage, and it was paid off in about 12 years. So now the farm's paid for. But through the 60s, it was basically a glorified homestead. You know, we had a big garden. We milked two Guernsey cows. We made butter and buttermilk and cottage cheese. We had a little herd of cows, about, you know, 10 or 12 head, raised, you know, two pigs a year for us to, you know, for us to eat. I had my first chickens when I was 10, and I supplied the family with eggs. And that was really, and so the calves were sold at the local sale barn. The pigs we did ourselves. We had a neighbor that liked butchery, and so he came over and taught us how to field dress a beef and field dress a pig. And of course, neighbors would do that as well. And so we were basically, you know, we had our own firewood, and so we were essentially eating and heat and stuff on our own. But there was no business. There was no real economic thing. I suppose at that time, selling whatever 5 or 6 calves a year, that probably paid the taxes, you know. But it didn't really do anything else. And Dad devoted those years then to experimentation. He started looking at controlled grazing, developing an electric fencing system. We started composting. We got the wood chipper. And so by the time I'm in high school, the farm is still not a going concern, but we can start seeing the glimmer of, you know, of fertility and opportunity. And so the most important thing to remember is when I was about 14, my chickens, now I'm 4 years into it, and I've got whatever, a couple hundred chickens, and I need an outlet for eggs. And I was always the, you know, the whatever, the gregarious, you know, kind of talker, marketer, whatever. And we had an old curb market in Stanton at that time. Now, Stanton is 10 miles away. It's a town of 20,000 people, so it's not real big, but, you know, big enough. And they had started basically a farmer's market in the Depression back in the 30s so that farmers could direct market stuff. And they had an arrangement with the health department that if you were a kid and you were in 4-H or FFA, if you were a woman and you were in home extension homemakers clubs, if you were a man and you were in the Cattlemen's Association, so all these were kind of, you know, government extension education outfits. If you were joined one of those, the health department would not impose any food safety requirements on you. So I grew up, so I started going there when I was about 14, and from 14 to 18, we were there. It was an indoor market, and by the time we went, there were only 2 elderly matrons left. And in the 30s and 40s, there were 100 vendors. I mean, it was huge. It was like a local Walmart, you know, in the day. And many farmers actually, you know, paid their taxes and I mean, I know one lady, I mean, all the people are deceased now, but I remember her saying that she and her husband were able to build their house from the money she made making pies, you know, and selling them down at curb market.
Wow. What? What?
And so when I went, it was me and these 2 elderly matrons. They took me under their wing, showed me how to message, how to deal with customers, signage, pricing. I get all teary. You remember those? I mean, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. It was wonderful.
Wow. That's an amazing entry, you know, that story. And one of the things, I mean, there's a whole lot of little tidbits in there, but one of them, it sounds like the farm that what became a successful, you know, your eggs and on to a successful business was born out of years of just kind of homesteading and focusing on providing for yourselves, getting systems working, improving the land. Yes. And there were some natural outcomes, eggs being one of those. There's kind of natural outflows out of those efforts that had synergy probably with your interests, what the land could produce, some things like that. Is that a good lesson to pull there?
Absolutely it is. In fact, when I was about 16 or 17, I'm in high school, and you know, this is before the homeschooling movement took off, and I'm committed. I mean, I remember when Dad and I had the talk. I don't know, 16 or 17. We had it out at the dog leg out in the, what we call the dog leg, in one of the farm lanes makes a turn. It was on a Sunday morning, and not Sunday morning. It was just an evening, I think, or it was in the morning. It was in the morning for sure. And we had the talk, and he asked me, you know, what do you want to do? You know, with your life? I said, I want to be here. I want to be here for my life, my vocation. I want to be here. And from that day on, he quit investing in things. So if we needed something, I started buying things, you know, equipment. I would pay for the fixing the roof on the barn, different things. And he really, you know, backed away to let me enjoy the front end of that. And, you know, I make with so many families, you know, on succession, and the elder generation, you know, they want to take it to the grave, you know, that they just that, you know, that ability to delegate and let the next generation make those decisions is a hard thing for old hermit curmudgeon farmers to give up. But he was quick to do so. And it was really foundational. But during those years, we did a lot of experimenting. We would try things, and those trials, then by the time I came back full time, September 24, 1982, by the time I came back full time, those experiments, the ones that succeeded, became the foundation for our farm business. The ones that failed protected us from pouring money we didn't have into another rat hole. Yeah. And so the off-farm incomes provided a safety net to do some experiments. Some were costly, some were not, but they really helped us so that 20 years later, like I said, we came in 61. Now we're at September 24, 1982. So we're literally 20 years of this kind of off-farm cushion and experimentation time. When we launched, we had a lot of experience and experiments under our belt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm thankful you're here, and I'm thankful for the platforms and technology we have, because hopefully we can help people accelerate that journey a little bit. And learning from a life of experience like yours and others out there, because people feel a real need and a real passion. And I mean, obviously we both love encouraging homesteading and all that entails that, but the freedom of owning a business and entrepreneurship, I think, is another key in that. And people are just so hungry, but it is a journey. Hopefully we can help them shorten it.
And I will tell you, you know, I do a lot of conference speaking, a lot of, you know, these homestead festivals are, you know, just popping up everywhere. And routinely I'll ask you got a room of 500 or 600 people. How many of you, if you could actually make a living on your homestead, would leave your town job and do it? And all the time, it's way over half the hands go up. Now, some people love their work. They're really doing well. It's very compatible with a homestead lifestyle. And some of them, you know, aren't interested. But I can tell you, the yearning of the human spirit to be a butcher, baker, or candlestick maker, you know, on your own, is truly powerful. And often, homestead hobbies become the launch pad for initial little, you know, toe dips into a business.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the beautiful things, this is a little bit of a sideways, but today with the technology we have, is a lot of people are able to take their work, you know, home, and that's right. A great transition. because yes. they got Zoom, we've got all this technology, and more and more people are able to, matter of fact, with the School of Traditional Skills, we're able to hire people that can work from home and do a job they love and yet pursue, you know, their homesteading dream. So that's great. But then, like you said, over half of those people are like, yeah, but I want the freedom of an entrepreneurial nut life. I want to turn this homesteading life into a living. And so let's dive into a little bit about the mindset of a business owner, entrepreneur, because I think one thing that people often don't realize is that there's more to learn than just a skill. There's more to learn than just how to raise hens and sell eggs, you know, profitably, and profitably leans into some of those things to learn, or whatever it is there's going to do. There's a mindset, just like there's a mindset to homesteading, there's a mindset to a business person that they need to learn some other skills and think about some other things, not just that trade, if you will.
Yes. Well, there's a whole list of these. I mean, obviously think about your taxes. And so for example, at our, you know, when we started, remember I told you dad was a tax accountant. Mm-hmm. So, one of the things that we did was we started a C corp, as Polyface Incorporated, and the corporation, the business, then rents the land from us. And so for Teresa and I, when we started out, our income was unearned income and therefore not subject to FICA tax. Mm-hmm. And that saved us thousands and thousands of dollars initially. And I know dad set up, for example, I know he was working with, I never knew who all his clients were, but I knew one of them was two Mennonite ladies that ran a daycare center in their home. And he set them up this way so that the daycare center rented their home, and their income then was not a salary. It was unearned income. And I mean, you can take a nominal salary just to not make any red flags, but you know, you need to think about taxes, all sorts of things regarding taxes, capital gains, depreciation, write-offs. And so, you know, get a good aggressive accountant who most of us, you don't know enough about taxes, especially business type things, to be able to make these things. So the first item on my list is get a good accountant that will be aggressive and design your system so that it'll minimize your taxes. Of course, closely related to that is financial records.
Yeah.
And most small businesses keep horrific financial records. And I was, again, dad was an accountant. And so the financial records are all about categories. You can't just lump, for example, if you're raising pigs and chickens, you can't just have a category for feed. If you're buying feed, you need to have it separate for the layers, the broilers, the anything that you're buying feed for. You need to, if you're buying fertilizer, and this is not organic or inorganic. If you're buying soil amendments, that needs to go into, if you're doing vegetables, separate your vegetable soil amendments from your pasture livestock soil amendments. What I'm getting at is categories. And right now on our farm, Josh, I think we have, Teresa would tell me, she keeps the books, but I think we have over 200 categories, but those categories are how you tease out your margins. Yeah. If you can't identify your enterprise expense and your enterprise income, you need to break off that individual enterprise. And I realize a lot of people, when they start, they might only have one enterprise. Okay, I get that. But often you have subsets of enterprises. Very, very quickly. Most businesses, yes, they have a mothership, but then they have other things. You know, if you're making candles, it would be easy to break off between aromatic candles and utility candles, maybe, you know, if there's a power outage. You know, those are two different lines of, you know, two different lines of product. So financial records are just so critical. And then sales, marketing. Who's going to do the sales and marketing? A lot of people are not natural salespeople. They get the shudders and get chills, you know, the thought of making a call to a potential customer. So so sales and marketing a lot of times will not be you. You know, it'll be a friend, it'll be somebody that has a skill in sales that enjoys the game of matching wits with a customer, you know, and finding one. And you put them on a commission. Almost all sales are on a commission. So you're not obligated for, you know, for payment. If they sell more, you make more, they make more, you know. And so sales and marketing is a big deal because many, many small businesses are just not good, you know, at sales and marketing. Cash flow. Okay. Cash flow. I mean, almost all small businesses. Oh, let me back up. The most common reason that small businesses fail is not because they don't have a good service or a good skill or, you know, something good, a good product. It's because of cash flow. The bills are coming in faster than the incomes and there's some glitch. And especially with farming, when you're dealing with seasonality, I mean, we dealt with this, Mike, early on, you know, the only thing we had was beef. So I'm starting to direct market and sell beef. And then we added the chickens pretty quickly, but the chickens were done in October as well. And so for our first several years, Teresa and I did not get any income between October and May. And we had to stretch that. We had to build up enough to make it through the winter. And then what did I do? I started cutting firewood. Okay. Firewood was something I could do in the winter. That was when the market was, because one of the first goals when you start a business is to become fully employed. Most of your services and products actually are profitable, but they don't work because you're not spending enough time at profitable things. And so when you make a calendar January through December, put down where you're busy and where you're not in your business. Where, you know, this business, am I going to be busy this month, you know, where am I going to be busy? And then if you have a couple of months that are really, really low and you say, well, my lands, you know, what am I going to do this month? Well, think about something that could be done at that time that would bring that cash flow up so it's steady, you know, through the season. Don't add something where you're already busy. You know, that's one reason why we don't dairy. We don't dairy. Why? We've got the broiler chickens. They're a 6-month seasonal on pasture program. If we did a seasonal grass-based dairy, we would be adding an enterprise when we're already almost too busy.
Yeah.
So we want to add enterprises that we can do, you know, off season. That's why woodworking and firewood, sawmills, that kind of off season winter work is so complementary to a livestock or a vegetable outfit. And of course, if you're doing vegetables, you can season extend. That's another way, you know, so with greenhouses and with root cellars, you can extend your season so that with a root cellar, you've got potatoes and cabbage and squash to sell all the way through the winter. And you don't have to finish in 1st of November and not have anything to sell until the first vegetables are ready in May. So cash flow is a big one. Customer service. You know, how are you going to interact with your customers? Which brings me to social media, email lists. You know, a lot of us, certainly me, I'm not social media savvy. I don't even have a smartphone. I've still got a flip phone. So what do I have to do? I have to team up. I have to partner with people. And when you're starting out, this can just be a friend. It can be a nephew, niece, a daughter, a son. Okay. Somebody who's, you know, who's under 18 years old and social media savvy, and have them set up a website, your social media, do a monthly blog. You start this story, and this story is what drives people to you in that way. And finally, I would just say, you know, licenses and compliance. I mean, that is becoming a bigger issue these days. And you know, I'm a pretty ask forgiveness, not permission. But there are things that you can really get in trouble about. One of which is selling illegal meat. I mean, they will get you if you've got meat stamped not for sale because it's custom processed, and you start selling that T-bone steak by itself. Let me tell you, you will get a visit and it will not be good. And so there are some minimal things. I mean, for example, when we butchering chickens here, the health department wanted us to check the well for potable water. Hmm. And so, you know, that was one that we didn't fight on. We didn't feel like it was in our business interest to look at the health department and say, no, we don't think potable water is important. That doesn't mesh well, you know, with your messaging. And so, you know, we got the water, and it turned out we needed to put a UV filter on the water, a UV light, ultraviolet light, and that kills coliforms. And the water was good; it passed, and we're all good to go. So choose your hills, but that licensing and compliance, you know, some things are important to jump through some hoops if just so you're not sitting there looking over your shoulder every day. Yeah. I mean, that's not a fun way to live.
No, and those aren't, I mean, you gotta be really choosy about your battles there. If you're going to start up and get a successful business going, you gotta be careful where you choose your battles. We may not like certain things but yeah, your goal is to get this thing off the ground, right? And generate income. Man, there's a whole lot there. I want to go back and revisit a couple things for people. You're just touching on so many great things. One is the need to set up and be intentional about a business structure. You mentioned the C Corp. There's different structures people may not realize. And a lot of times they just go what we'd call the self-employed route, right? They don't really create any entity. And so, you know, what you're alluding to is not just getting good accounting, but getting somebody that can help you set up a proper entity that is going to save you money, going to shelter. You're going to do multiple things. There are tools out there that are very worth using. And I don't think Joel, you or I can say which one's best for which person, but look at it, think about it, and find a structure that works for you.
Yeah. There's sub S corporations. There's, of course, when we started Polyface back in 1982, LLCs didn't exist. LLCs have come on since then.
Wow.
And so we now, in the last 10 years, we've bought some land. We bought a lot with a house on it nearby for staff housing. So we have an LLC that owns property. And again, Polyface can rent that land, and that then pays the mortgage, and it reduces our tax bite. We co-own a slaughterhouse, and that's an LLC as well. So the LLC, as you know, has really come on. It's fairly simple to get, and the reason you want that is to create a veil of protection between your business and your wealth. I don't know if you've ever been sued. We've been sued, and I'm telling you what, when you're sued, it is not fun. And so whatever you can do to create it was a wreck. One of our delivery drivers had a wreck. And an ambulance chaser came after us for, you know, $1 million. But again, by having separate business interests, it protects your liability, and that's a really good thing.
Have you ever read, I'm assuming you have, but maybe not. Have you ever read Robert Kiyosaki's Cash Flow Quadrant?
Oh yeah. Long time ago when it first came out. Yeah.
Well, and I would encourage everybody here to read it. It was very foundational for me, but one of my big takeaways, Joel, is just these things. It teaches you how to think like a business person instead of just an employee or even a self-employed person. And he makes a distinguishment between employed, self-employed versus a business person, and then an investor, which is to the side here. But it's just what you're talking about and learning to separate things out. And there's a lot of advantages to that, business advantages, legal protections, like you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can shift monies around. You know, so our business fiscal year, our Polyface fiscal year is not on the calendar year. Our Polyface fiscal year is April 1 to March 31, March 31. And that's, of course, a quarter off of personal taxes. Mm-hmm. So we can move money around to avoid taxes. Yeah, dump it back in. We can make a loan. I mean, I don't want to get down too far in the rabbit hole, but again, your entities enable you to shift. I mean, this is what the Rockefeller Foundation does. This is what, you know, this is what these outfits do, is they have all these entities that they're able to, you know, to shift monies around.
Yeah. And then there are legal strategies and
absolutely.
People, if you're starting a business, you need to understand there are tools that are available to you. Do they cost a little money to set up? Yes. But do they save you a ton of money in the long run and protect you? Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk cash flow for a minute. I think that is just huge. As people are learning to understand financial statements, they need to learn how to read a profit and loss and a balance sheet a little bit. You need to learn, at least have somebody keep good records for you, right? And learn to analyze those. One thing that people don't realize, I've found, Joel, is that people will see that they're profitable on the books and they'll see profit. But if your cash flow isn't working well, you can still have major problems and sink your business because of the timing you were talking about the cash coming in.
Right.
Can you expound on that a little bit? Because that can be a trap. You can think, wow, I'm profitable. I'm showing that I'm making money on the chickens. But depending on when that cash is going in versus coming in versus when the expenses are going out and how that cash is moving can be tricky.
Yeah, so mapping out. So, you know, I talked about a labor flow chart. You can also do a cash flow chart. And you can look at whatever your product is. You know, you can look when is that income coming in, and when are the expenses, when are the cost of goods coming due to get that done.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are investments that you can make that appear to be a profitable investment, but if the cost of that investment has to be paid before the income comes in, excuse me, it might not be a good investment. Even though it might look good on paper, it might snowball into a real problem when the payments are due. So this is just a pretty simple thing. You know, we're talking to, you know, people that are kind of starting. You know, we're not talking here to people that are running a $4 million business. Okay.
Right.
And so this cash flow thing is a lot easier, you know, to do when you're real small.
Yeah, it is, but you got to know it so that you understand, because every business is going to, you're going to have to spend money. You're going to have to spend energy. Some of it's your labor, but you still got to spend cash dollars for materials, for chicks, for feed, whatever it is you're doing. And you got to have a plan for that cycle of spending and income coming in and spending, especially when you're getting started. And hopefully you've got some money in the bank, which could be a whole nother discussion point here. What do you need to get started?
That's exactly, as you started down this path, that's where I was headed, was when people asked me, you know, we're going to make the jump, you know, what do we need? And so there's always a lag between your capitalization. You know, maybe you need to build a structure. We'll stay with the chickens. You need to buy a plucker and a scalder. You're going to have, you know, $7,000 or $8,000 in you know, some stainless steel tables and some plumbing and, you know, a roof and you're to get started. And so that's why one of the biggest temptations I see with homesteaders is they want as much acreage as they can get. So they got this little nest egg. They got this little nest egg, and they put it and they buy as big an acreage as they can get.
Mm-hmm.
15, 20, 30 acres, okay? Sometimes 100 acres, all right? They put all, and then suddenly there's no capital left to capitalize the enterprises they want to do. And I mean, if you want to build a hoop house, you know, a tall tunnel, you know, those things are, if you have any kind of size at all, you know, they're going to be a few thousand dollars. Any kind of livestock facility, barn, I mean, goodness, a tractor, you know, anything like this is going to take money. So I encourage people to, if you've got a $400,000 nest egg, put 200 in the land, and that saves you 200 to be able to build fence and tall tunnels and you know, a refrigerator and processing equipment and, you know, whatever you need to get this thing up and running. You know, a sawmill, a woodworking saw, whatever, you know, chainsaws. I mean, a shop, just outfitting the rudimentary tools of a shop with you know, chainsaw, post hole diggers, come along, jacks, you know, it's you can go down to Lowe's and spend, you know, $4,000 in a heartbeat. You get some box end wrenches and some, you know, channel locks and vice grips and, boy, you know, fence stretchers and come alongs and, you know, tie downs and ratchets and, oh my goodness, it, you know, goes fast. Buy as you can. All you can always either add to your holdings or you can trade up. And most of the time, if you invest 4 or 5 years in your homestead and you have actually made it really attractive and pretty and you've got some fruit trees going and things, you can normally, maybe, you know, maybe you built a little pond and okay. Think about aesthetics. I mean, one of my forestry mentor was a guy named Bill Brownworth. He drove a tank in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. He got out of the military, World War II. Guy that no money, no nothing, all right? But he's a born salesman. So he went to work for still chainsaw, you know, equipment, all right, as a salesman. In New Jersey, he was able to buy a very, very small, like, you know, 30-acre place in 1950, okay? And he built a couple ponds. He upgraded the woodlot, the trees, turned into a real pretty place. And in just about 6 years, he doubled his money and bought a 200-acre place in Pennsylvania. When it did the same thing, built a couple ponds, thinned out the trees, planted some trees, you know, prettied it up. About 7 years, doubled or tripled his money. When I met him, he was, I don't know what, in his late 50s, back in the, you know, I met him in about 1980 or 81. And he had upgraded to where at that point he bought 3 large properties here in our county, which is one of the reasons I met him, And it had taken him, 25 years, but he just prettied up a place, doubled his money, prettied up a place, doubled his money. And I think too often, newbies especially are already intimidated by 10 acres and they're thinking of this as a, well, this is my one chance in a lifetime. No. Land comes up for sale all the time, all the time. Land is it comes up for sale. And so a lot of the people who have actually moved to, bigger places have done it incrementally. But by doing that, you hold on to your nest egg, you hold on to your capitalization. So if you need a piece of equipment, you're not pressed. I went on too long on that, but anyway, it's a great story. He was my forestry mentor. I mean, I worked with him. He was bigger than life and just wonderful. And his story of just slowly and progressively, to where when I knew him, he had, he owned 1,000 acres of nice, Virginia land.
Yeah, well, you bring out, and I mean, not everybody's, the land and real estate investments one way, not everybody's going to do that. But I think you draw out the need to have an expectancy of it taking some time for a business to work. And people, as you know, are motivated right now. They're passionate. They're wanting to make changes. But there are some things that just take a little bit of time of wise investment in the land you're buying and whatever the business is you're pursuing and how you go about it. Do you see over the years, maybe in some of these, whether it's, raising chickens or beef or market gardening, do you see a time frame that it takes for people on average, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years to get from startup to maybe not there, wherever there is, whatever the end goal of success is, but to get up and running and bringing in income that's helping you support yourself reasonably well or completely, do you see any trends or guidelines there? I know there are some in business in general, but within this world that we're talking about, what do people expect if they're going to try to start up a business? Because they're not going to start it up and 6 months later, you're making a good profit and living off of it. That's going to be the Hollywood or YouTube exception, right? Somebody that just launches ahead. Yes, those happen, but that's the dream. That's not the common reality.
Yeah, no, it's not. And as you know, our culture has become very impatient.
Yeah.
We want it all yesterday. In general, I encourage people that are really serious about this to have a nest egg big enough to live on for 2 years. So you can get your groceries, keep your car running. I mean, and you can survive for 2 years. That will get, and if you can survive for 2 years and be 100% devoted to what you're doing, you'd be surprised how fast you can learn if you're not distracted. What this means is, we're back to the Dave Ramsey thing. You're not going to eat out. You're not going to go on Caribbean cruises. Teresa and I did not take, well, we don't take vacations. I mean, we love what we do. We need to go anywhere. When I want to get away, I come home, But we didn't take a true, vacation, for probably 7 or 8 years, and then we took a little bit away. And for us, I can tell you, for us, it was the end of our third year that we were able to breathe. So when I left outside employment, September 24, 1982, we had enough to live on for 1 year. But remember, we were already 20 years into this, into the homesteading. So we had a lot of good, whatever skill, under our, And we had connections. We lived in the community for 20 years. So people knew us. When I walked into a store, you know, or walk, you know, we weren't moving to, you know, to Tennessee and plopping down with, you know, 100,000 other, you know, homestead refugees from California, you know, expecting it to, you know, to materialize. And so we had 1 year, and because we were living frugally, you know, we drove a $50 car. We, I mean, to show you how frugal Dad was, he didn't want a pickup truck. He didn't want to have two vehicles. And so he bought a, remember, he's a tax accountant. So he, you know, he's driving around to these, he wears a, you know, a suit and a tie and all this. He bought a 1957 four-door Plymouth for $50 from a neighbor. Took all the door. This is in the 60s, okay? No car inspection. So this is before car inspection. This is when we were a free country. And I took all the doors off, all the seats out, sat on a overturned bucket, and drove to a client's in this old 1957 Plymouth. And when you take all the seats and everything out of a old car like that, it's got a compartment the size of a pickup truck, and it's even covered. And so he would get calves and pigs and chickens, and that was basically our pickup truck, but it actually doubled as a town car as well. And so those kinds of, how do you live just cutting your expenses to almost nothing, has everything to do with how long this nest egg will go. When you come to homesteading, leave your city stuff behind and let your homestead, you know, the frogs in the creek, that's your new entertainment. The, you know, the picnic table by the, you know, by the edge of the woods, that's your new entertainment. And it's a completely changed mindset, but you don't need to pay for entertainment. You don't need to pay for recreation. You know, trust me, the first time the cows get out, you're going to have all the recreation you can stand for, you know, for a few hours. So enjoy it, but that enjoyment doesn't require a lot of money. So, you know, I like a 2-year nest egg, but it does make a big difference. Your savvy and your experience level in whatever you're going to do.
Yeah. And making the most of your efforts, whether it's dollars spent or steps taken or energy consumed, you know, kind of like that car, it's like stacking functions before we knew what permaculture was, really.
Right. Right. Oh yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk about something a minute that was, it's been implicit overall in this conversation, but you haven't said it directly. And that is a diversity of revenue streams. You know, we know, like, if we're working on the land, you know, regeneratively, we want diverse ecosystems, diverse animal systems. What about a business? How important is it to develop multiple income streams versus focusing on one? And then the follow-up to that's going to be, then how do you start, right?
Yeah. So, innovation is expensive because innovation inherently comes with failure. And so you cannot innovate in too many things at once, or you'll get frustrated and you'll go bankrupt. So my suggestion is, What do you think right now is a potential business? You know, what is your, well, in business, we call this an unfair advantage. What do you know how to do? What does your area, need? What's your unfair advantage that you are uniquely able to do or know about, that others don't know? And start there first, because if your unfair advantage creates a firewall of competition protection against everybody who would, you know, jump in and do what you do. And so think about needs, think about what you want to do, what you like to do. And it's okay to have multiples, but pick one and concentrate on it. Get good at it. You know, the old mastery concept of of 10 years and 10,000 hours. I mean, you alluded to that a little bit without saying the 10,000 hours, but you can't shortcut mastery. Mastery requires time. I mean, I can teach anybody how to gut a chicken in, you know, about 5 minutes, but you don't become a master until you gut a stewing hen, you know, an old rooster, on a cold day, on a hot day, on a rainy day, on a, you know, when the wind is blowing, you know, all these, you know, when the water pump went down and you're trying to just make it happen with carrying water and sprinkle cans. It's all those nuances that create mastery. And so what happens is you develop your mastery in one item or service, and then that finances or subsidizes your next enterprise. Now, obviously, if you can't get one thing profitable, you know, it can't subsidize anything else. So, you know, our discussion about profitability, and we haven't even mentioned the word margins, but margins are absolutely critical. You have to know what your, so a margin, you've got your direct costs and your overheads. Okay. What I call enterprise costs and overheads. So overheads are things like taxes, insurance, anything that you would have, whether you had a business or not. Direct expenses are things that you only buy because you're running this business. If we weren't raising eggs, we wouldn't buy layer feed. Your margin, your enterprise margin, is your costs, is your income of that enterprise minus your direct costs, and that should be 30 to 40%. Now that's not your profit. Because that is going to go to your overheads.
Right.
So the idea is, so there's only three ways to increase profit. You can reduce your expenses. You can increase your price. So you can reduce your costs, increase your price, or if you have a positive margin, you can increase turnover. Those are the only three ways you can actually increase profit. And of course, turnover is how Tyson does it. You know, Tyson doesn't make but whatever, a dime on a chicken, okay? But they're doing billions of chickens.
Right.
And so it works. And so this is why your accounting categories are so important. So you can tease out, you can separate the various expense and income streams and allocate them to the various enterprises. We've tried numerous things in the past. We've tried pheasants. We've tried numerous things in the past, and for 2 or 3 years, and give them up. We couldn't make them work. Okay,
sure.
And we're pretty creative. All right, some things won't work for you. They just won't. And so, you know, give it a year or two. You know, do all you can. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And then you can, you know, go do something else. So the question was about diversity. And yes, the more income streams you can have, the more stable your whole business becomes. Because the single hardest part in sales, in marketing, is finding a new customer. That's the hardest part. If you have a happy customer buying, you know, flowers, they say, well, what else can I get? Can I get blackberries? Can I get decorative grapevine wreaths? Can I get, whatever. What, children's woodworking toys, whatever. But the hardest part in marketing is penetrating our hurried, harried, frenzied, flustered lives of people and saying, stop here, look at me, I got my hand up, I'm here, look at me. But once you have their attention, they're immediately going to ask, hey, I'm happy with this product or service. What else do you guys offer?
Yeah.
And those then become very, very cheap marketing sales.
I think I've heard you say it somewhere. I think it was you. It's easier to get 100 customers spending $1,000 each than it is to get 1,000 customers spending $100.
That's right. Yeah. And that's where this multiple income streams comes in.
Yeah.
So you're always looking at, what is a complementary income stream? Figuring out how to do it.
But to recap it, so we can cover a couple other things before we run out of time. Diversity is key. It's good for long-term successful business. But to start, I think what I heard you saying is find your sweet spot, find your unfair advantage, that place where you can hit the market, you're good at it. Get that down, master it. That gives you momentum,
right?
And it's going to give you bandwidth, both in energy and capital, to then start spinning off and finding those other, diversities in your revenue stream.
Yeah, that's for sure. One of the most important equities, the most important business equity you can have is your own confidence that you can actually do this.
Yeah. Got to believe that.
Yeah. You've got to believe that. And so, Dave Ramsey has his snowball effect. And what you've just described is the snowball effect in reverse, where you start with something, a prototype, start with something small, and you get it efficient, profitable, and it's running, and then you can add complementary things, and a lot of the time, the complementary things will just. They'll just appear while you're listening to customers or if you have a need. For example, we didn't have pigs for years and years. We didn't have pork. So I was at this conference and I saw a presentation about rare breeds of pigs by the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. And I'm sitting there and a slide comes up and there's these red wattle pigs. But what excited me was the pigs were obviously standing on a steaming pile of horse manure. And the pig had, all this manure stuff all over his nose. It was like an epiphany for me. Huh, of course. We don't need to double handle compost and make these windrow compost piles. We'll just let pigs do it. And I came home and I bought two pigs and put them in to do the compost. And it was marvelous. It was fantastic. And so so we got into pigs. I'm not sure what year that was. We were probably, I'm going to say, we might have been full time here for 8 or 9 years before we started with pigs. But the thing was, when we got the pigs, and we sold them then. It was easy to sell two pigs, to our, we had all these customers. Well, they liked the pork so much, everybody wanted pork. So then we moved the pigs from what's called a hole-on. So a hole-onic business is a business that you start to salvage a waste stream from something else.
Yeah.
So the reason the hole-onic business works is because you don't have to put very much expense in it. In other words, our eggmobile is a perfect example of a holonic business. The chickens eliminate the need for headgate work, grubicides, parasiticides. They spread out the cow patties. If those chickens never laid an egg, they would still be beneficial because of what they do from a livestock sanitation and fertility management program. So the eggs are basically cream. Now, the eggs, people liked them so much they wanted more eggs. Well, we didn't need that many, you know, chickens to go behind the cows. So we began raising chickens on the, you know, in the pasture in the called the Millennium Feather Net. But that is not a hole on. That is a business, and the Eggmobile is a holonic business because it is taking cow manure and bugs that the cows expose, converting it into eggs. So there's very little actual cost involved. But the Millennium Feather Net, where it's 1,000 chickens and they're moved every couple of days on pasture, we feed them more. That is actually a business. And so, you know, that a lot of the times your next enterprise will be something that you're seeing, oh, we could use that waste stream and do this with it. Or it's something that the customer, your customers are coming back saying, I like this and this. I'd really like you to do this. Could you do this? You know, you're raising, zucchini and yellow crookneck squash. I'd really love butternuts. Can you raise a fall crop of butternuts for me? You know, and that's a lot of the times the way the diversification actually goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very natural succession, if you will.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, I know we're getting down on time. I wanted to cover one or two other things. And you travel, obviously, all the time, all over the place. You're meeting a lot of people. You really have your finger on the pulse of what's happening. That combined with your own just, rich experience in farming, are there businesses you think today, maybe in the general market, are there certain startups that are worth the homesteader thinking about? So I'm looking to give people ideas. Or are there some things that in general, and obviously you got very regional, skill specific regional areas, and so that's hard to address, but in general, are you seeing things that are suited for homesteaders that there's maybe common need for in the market? And on the other side, are you seeing things that are maybe popular that people are getting into that's a bit of a trap, that's a little dangerous, that they need to think? I don't know, but it that would be the flip side of the coin, you know.
Yeah. So the opportunities, I think, are the ones that I see on the horizon, that I think are completely unexploited right now, are caregiving farms that their income is actually caregiving. This could be elder care, it could be daycare, it could be autistic adults. I can't tell you how many startups I'm seeing that are in this caregiving space. So the actual, and in Europe, they've been doing this for years and years. And they have, you know, healthcare, and they actually promote non-institutionalized caregiving. And so there are many farmers in Europe who pad their dairies and stuff with, you know, brain injured, autistic, different kinds of individuals that are on some sort of a healthcare, you know, program, whether it's insurance or government. There, it's mainly government. But a lot of these people can do a lot of things. They can put away eggs. They can, you know, they're not stupid and they're not, you know, dumb, but they they can't quite function in a normal workplace situation. And they are perfectly happy to, you know, clean out some cow stalls or plant. This is not demeaning. This is actually respecting people who otherwise would just be in our country. We would just lock them away in an institution and give them drugs. There, they actually promote and embrace deinstitutionalizing, getting them out where they can actually be honored into something that they can do. And so I think I what I'm seeing here, and you know, Josh, we're our culture in the next 10 years, we are going into a shock of autism and the baby boomers that are aging out, and our healthcare costs are just skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And so if you've got some savvy, if one of you is a registered nurse, if one of you is a physical therapist, if there are people that can bring skills to the rural setting that can offer incredible opportunities in care for their community in a farm setting. By the way, another one in the same space is delinquents, juvenile delinquents. People, I'm seeing more and more Christians start farms that are basically halfway houses where they're taking inmates transitioning. And so the farm income, the income is not production. The income is some sort of counseling, care, transitional thing that insurance or Social Security or something pays for. And the farm production itself simply becomes a conducive habitat for that kind of transition or that kind of care. And I think as much as this country is spending on healthcare, I think that is a really, really burgeoning space. Addictions, drug addictions, all this. We just have massive. And so if you have a heart for this, now, obviously, some of us aren't, we're not conducive to that. Okay. Or you don't [S2] Sure. [S1] Want your family invaded or, whatever, but there are a lot of situations where you can enter this on a very small scale. I mean, look at foster care. Foster care pays, what is it? In Virginia, I think foster care pays $3,000 a month. And we know a couple that's homesteading, and basically their income is foster care. And they take two, three, four of these, and the state pays them. And they can, these, not all of them work out. And of course it's a revolving thing, but a lot of these young people thrive when they see the miracle of a garden and the miracle of a calf being born and get to gather eggs and cook and working. I mean, there are a lot of things here that are, palliative that a homestead can offer. We know that. And so I think this is an opportunity that a lot of people are not examining, that have a heart for it, that can really change the financial trajectory.
Wow. Those are just some beautiful concepts that improve the quality of life of people, especially of some of these people groups that have not good quality of life. What an opportunity. I'm fairly mind blown at the moment. So I'm just spinning. That is just really neat. Those are some neat ideas, and it kind of ties into what was going to be my last question or last thought for you. And that is, I mean, it ties right into it. Do people need to, make an income directly from the homesteading activities, which you're saying no, but let's explore that, because I think a lot of people, they're going homesteading, they're looking for a business. So they naturally just think, I'm going to sell eggs, I'm going to sell beef, I'm going to do a market garden, all great things, but we only need so many people selling beef and so many people raising market gardens somewhere. I don't think we have balance right now, but somewhere in an area you're going to hit balance. We need people doing other things.
Yes.
So does it have to be part of your homesteading activities to live a homesteading life and start a business that's based out of home and out of that life that you're seeking?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I mean, again, my dad was an accountant. He worked out of the home. Clients came here. He'd go to their home, but he worked out of the home. Mom was a school teacher. Well, that wasn't very conducive to being at home. But there are a lot of things. We have a shop here on the farm, a very, very well-equipped shop, because we've got a lot of equipment. And we're not a backyard operation. We've got whatever, 10 tractors or something. I mean, this is a serious deal. But this shop, the guy that handles that shop, fixes things in our community when he's not working for Polyphase. And so in the evening or weekends, he'll come in there and he'll do a brake job for a neighbor. He'll do things. Now, that's our shop. But if you have mechanical ability, everybody needs things that can be fixed. That they've all got things that can be fixed. And so think about acquiring skills. I mean, perhaps, if you're thinking about this, the best investment you could make is go to some vocational courses in mechanics or HVAC, or learn how to plumb a house, get your electrical. I mean, all the trades, as you know, Josh, all the trades are all aging out, and that's good money. I mean, those guys, you hire an electrician or a plumber, they're not charging you $20 an hour. I mean, these guys are 50, 60, they're, and if you read the book, The Millionaire Next Door, you know that virtually all millionaires are blue collar. They're not white collar professionals. They're blue collar. And so, learn how to fix things, build things, repair things, grow things, and you'll be in good shape. So no, I am very much a believer in bring your skill to the homestead. Let your life experience drive your business opportunity. And if something develops from your actual homestead production, wonderful. That's just cream on your dream. Okay. That's just cream on your dream. But the safest thing is to leverage your 10, 15, 20 year vocational experience first, and then see how the homestead develops. You asked early on a question about what's the biggest mistake or where and I would simply say the biggest mistake on that is exotics, llamas, alpacas, a horse. These are expensive exotics, and they're exotics for a reason. They're very costly. And so one of the things about being a business is you've got to trim, you've got to prune down your druthers. You got to prune down your druthers, at least initially, so that you focus with laser focus attention on the successful enterprise at hand. And later on, you could have something warm and fluffy, okay? But the biggest mistake I see is people getting too wrapped up emotionally and economically in warm fuzzies and fluffies, and then that becomes a distraction.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great closing thought in what you mentioned there about not, I think you said, not throwing away, 10, 15 years of knowledge of experience. What a great leaping off point to think about if as we exit this conversation and you guys listening or thinking about a business, how do you take your past life experiences, your past career, as you're moving towards a homestead life, maybe an entrepreneurial life? How do you take those and instead of tossing them out and going and which we're doing, right? We're going for a new life. A lot of people are in this homesteading life and a new life maybe in business. But don't toss all that out. How do you apply it? How do you capitalize it? How do you use it to propel yourself forward to drive a potential business from the home and from the homestead? That's powerful.
Yeah, it is. You're leveraging it. You're leveraging it, not leaving it.
Yeah.
I think that's a real critical advantage for homeschooling.
I think so. Well, Joel, this has been a fun, rich conversation. I hope everybody out there has enjoyed. You guys watching, listening, you can get more information at the blog. There'll be a link below in the notes. You can go check out the blog post. I want to invite you to come see Joel speak at the Modern Homesteading Conference this summer in Idaho, second year. Wasn't that a blast, Joel, last year?
Oh, my. Yeah, fantastic. And Melissa tells me that it's going to double in size this year.
I knew it was getting bigger. Doubling is going to be huge. Wow. And what a lot of good energy and fun.
Oh, yeah.
People. So, yeah. We want to invite you guys to come check that out. Of course, you can learn more about what Joel's doing at polyfacefarms.com. And Joel, you've got a course called Farm Like a Lunatic that I think is a business course around farming. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about that before we go.
Well, yeah, it's not primarily business. There's a lot of business in it. Basically, okay. It's a video curriculum where we start with, you know, a raw canvas. Where do you get land? What are you looking for? How do you develop a landscape? And now we're into each enterprise, and we're gradually working through all of our different enterprises and doing a video curriculum on each of the different species and the different enterprises.
Okay. Well, very cool. Sounds very educational. So if that's something that's interesting of you guys, that'll be in the show notes or on the blog post, go check that out. Joel, it's been awesome hanging with you. Everybody else, been great. And we'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Pantry Chat, Food for Thought. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review.
To view the show notes and any other resources mentioned on this episode, you can learn more at homesteadingfamily.com/podcast.
We'll see you soon.
Goodbye.